This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We are here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, with 10 different topics every week. You'd like to take a look at the schedule so you can see what we'll be doing for the rest of the week, or sign up for podcasts or listen to past programs, just go to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this part of Focus, we'll continue talking about some of the issues that we dealt with in the first hour of the show today, talking about how it is that the U.S. government has dealt with people that it has labeled terrorists since September 11th. In June, just this past June, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that terror suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay have the right to challenge their detention in U.S. courts. This marks the third time that the court has ruled against the Bush administration on its treatment of those it considers enemy combatants. In this hour, what we want to try to do is to talk a little bit about these decisions, talk about certainly the most recent decision of the court, but also go back to the first decision. This was Russell v. Bush. The decision came down in 2004, and then talk about the decisions since and look at a little bit of the back and forth between the administration, the Congress, and the court on these issues, and also talk a little bit about where we are now. There are those who are now suggesting that the administration might well have to close Guantanamo. Others say that the fate of the people held there may well mostly rest with whoever is the next president of the United States. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an attorney from Chicago who has been involved in litigating on behalf of some Guantanamo detainees. His name is Gary Isaac, and he is with the firm of Meyer Brown, LLP, has been there with that firm since 1986. He's been involved in the Guantanamo litigation since the fall of 2003, when he co-authored two friend-of-the-court briefs in the Russell case. Since the decision in June 2004 in Russell, he's been involved with a group of attorneys bringing habeas actions on behalf of detainees. He was also very involved in the fall of 2005 in lobbying Congress against efforts to strip the courts of jurisdiction to hear petitions, habeas petitions from the detainees. And he's been with us before on the program, has been good enough to give us some more of his time today. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, the number, if you'd like to join the conversation. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Again, we just ask people who are calling to try to keep their questions brief, just so we can keep our program moving along. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. Mr. Isaac, hello.
Good morning. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Good. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us again. This is something that I'm trying to wrap my head around, and the legal issues and everything that's happened here is complicated. And so if you'll forgive me asking really basic questions,
that'll
help me, and I'm sure it'll help other people who are listening. And again, certainly the reason for wanting to have the conversation was to talk about the most recent case, the Moumedien case. But I think probably we should go back and just at least have you highlight these other cases, these three other cases, going back to 2004 and the decision of the court in Russell v. Bush.
Sure.
Essentially there, what did the court say?
Well, it actually pronounced Russell.
Oh, Russell.
If I may.
Yes.
And that decision was issued by the Supreme Court in 2004 in June. And what the court basically said in Russell was that the detainees at Guantanamo did have the right to go to federal court to challenge their detentions, and that the federal courts had jurisdiction over habeas petitions brought by detainees at Guantanamo, notwithstanding the government's argument that the courts did not have jurisdiction because the detainees were not U.S. citizens and were being held outside the sovereign territory of the United States.
Hmm. And so then after that decision, that would seem to be fairly clear. What happened?
Well, actually, this has been an extraordinary exercise lesson in separation of powers, because what you had is Guantanamo was created by the president, and there was an attempt by the president really to create a legal black hole at Guantanamo, a place where they can hold and interrogate prisoners without having any interference by the courts. The Russell case represented a repudiation of that by the judicial branch of the government, by the court, saying, we do have jurisdiction. in our system to entertain petitions for habeas corpus. What happened then is that the Bush administration and its allies in Congress sought in the fall of 2005 to pass legislation to strip the courts of the jurisdiction that the Supreme Court had held the courts had. And they did so in a statute called the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005. And that actually took us to the next Supreme Court case, the Hamdan case, H-A-M-D-A-N, which was decided in June of 2006. That case had to do with the it was the case of someone who was alleged to have been Osama bin Laden's driver, and he was one of the very small number of detainees at Guantanamo who were being charged with war crimes and who were going to be tried in front of these so-called military commissions that you've heard about. Most of the detainees, the vast majority of the detainees, have not been charged with any war crimes and were not being given military commission trials of any kind. But in the Hamdan case, the Supreme Court, in addition to striking down the military commission system that the Bush administration had set up for Mr. Hamdan and other alleged war criminals, the Supreme Court held that the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, and in particular the provision about the jurisdiction of the courts, did not apply to cases that had already been filed in court and were pending in court. It only applied in the future. And so that what then happened is in a couple of months later, in the fall of 2006, the Bush administration and its allies, again, led by Senator Graham and Senator McCain, actually went back to Congress and passed a new piece of legislation called the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which expressly applied the provision that attempted to take away the court's jurisdiction even to cases that were already in court. And then the constitutionality of that provision, that statute, was challenged in the case that the Supreme Court just decided a few weeks ago, the Boumediene case. Mm-hmm. And in the Boumediene case, the Supreme Court held that that statute did apply to pending cases. It was intended to apply to pending cases, but it was unconstitutional.
Hmm. Well, it seems to me that what the court continues to say, basically they continue to say over and over again the same thing, that is that the detainees have the right to challenge their detention in court. That is, they have the right to file a writ of habeas corpus. Why, I guess what I don't understand is why it is that the court continues to essentially affirm over and over and over again that they have the same right, nothing ever changes.
Well, that's been a source of frustration, certainly to the lawyers for the detainees, and most of all to the detainees, who many of whom are despairing of ever getting a hearing in court in the United States, even though there are these great pronouncements by the Supreme Court. I mean, the Supreme Court decisions are really, really important because the decision in the Boumediene case a few weeks ago really was a landmark case and a thorough affirmation of the importance of habeas corpus in our kind of scheme of government, in our democratic government, because it preserves separation of powers. Because what the Bush administration has tried to do, and in this they have been really aided and abetted by their supporters in Congress who have, largely abdicated, I think, their responsibility to act as a check and balance on the president. But what the Bush administration has tried to do is to gather to itself the unilateral authority and power to hold people at Guantanamo without having any court review of whether there's a basis for holding these people. And the Supreme Court has said in Rasul, they said in Hamdan, and they said again in Boumediene, no, in our constitutional system, the courts have the final say over whether or not the president can hold people. That's how we preserve our freedom. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, as a result of this most recent decision, for attorneys like you and others who have, have already filed habeas corpus petitions on behalf of their clients, and there may be some others who have not yet have that done for them, but what now does this mean? Is anything going, do you think at any time here in the near future, anything's going to change?
Well, I think the cases have now gone back to the district court in Washington, D.C., where all the habeas corpus cases have been filed in the district court in Washington, D.C., and really the fundamental point was a statement by the Supreme Court in the case a couple of weeks ago where they said that while some delay in fashioning new procedures is unavoidable, the cost of delay can no longer be borne by those who are held in custody. The detainees in these cases are entitled to a prompt habeas corpus hearing. And so we've gone back to the district court, and the cases are largely in front of a particular judge, Judge Hogan, who is endeavoring to coordinate some aspects of the case. But in essence, all of the lawyers for the detainees are now pressing to have exactly what the Supreme Court said the detainees are entitled to, which is prompt hearings in federal court, in which the detainees get the chance to either challenge the legal authority of the president to hold them or to bring up evidence that they have never had the opportunity to bring up before.
Mm-hmm. And just would that to happen, how much, if each of the each person got a chance to do that, how long would that take? Would it take us into next year, or could it actually happen before the election or before we had a new president?
Well, you know, David, I have to say, I mean, I think the administration throughout these proceedings has attempted to delay, and they attempted to delay after the Rasul decision. They did everything they could to drag out the proceedings. Then when that wasn't working, they had their allies in Congress pass these laws to try to take away the court's jurisdiction. I think they, you know, they will try to slow the process down again. And, you know, and on the other hand, the lawyers for the detainees will push to have hearings as soon as possible. I think hearings might start in, you know, around Labor Day, I suspect. It's hard to predict. But it's hard to imagine this entire mess being cleaned up before the Bush administration exit stage left.
Mm-hmm. And some of the things that I've read make it sound as if, in fact, if they got to the point of having a habeas hearing, that the administration would essentially have to admit that it really doesn't have, there are some people for whom it really doesn't have much in the way of evidence, and then that they might, in fact, end up just letting some people go because they know if it comes to that, they don't really have enough.
Well, I mean, there's certainly been a pattern of the administration's shrinking from ever having to actually produce evidence to support its determinations that individuals were enemy combatants. There's a good example. There was actually another case that that was decided at the same by the Supreme Court in June of 2004, at the same time as the Rasul case. It was a case called Hamdi, H-A-M-D-I, mm-hmm. And that was a case of a U.S. citizen. He actually had been brought up in Saudi Arabia, but he was a U.S. citizen because he'd been born in Louisiana before his family moved back to Saudi Arabia, and he was allegedly fighting with the Taliban against the U.S. in Afghanistan, and he had been held incommunicado for a long period of time. The administration said he was so dangerous he could not even be permitted to speak to his lawyer, and they did everything to keep him shut away. And the Supreme Court in the Hamdi case decided the same day as Rasul in 2004, said he's entitled to a hearing, and the administration is entitled to hold someone as an enemy combatant if they were fighting against us in Afghanistan, but he's entitled to a hearing to determine whether or not he is an enemy combatant. And believe it or not, shortly after the Supreme Court said that Mr. Hamdi was entitled to a hearing, this guy who was so dangerous that he was not even permitted to see a lawyer was released by the U.S. He was sent back to Saudi Arabia. That was the condition of his release. Basically, he'd go back to Saudi Arabia, wouldn't stay here. And so there have been other instances where the administration has trumpeted that, you know, how dangerous particular individuals were, but when they were put in a position where they were going to actually have to produce evidence to back up their assertions, they've chosen to release people, which suggests that they didn't have a basis from the start for the imprisonment.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Gary Isaac. He is an attorney with the firm of Meyer Brown LLP in Chicago, has practiced law there with the firm since 1986. He's also, for a number of years now, been involved in litigation on behalf of detainees at Guantanamo. He was involved in friend of the court briefs in these three major cases that he's talked a little bit about, Rasul, Hamdi, and Hamdan. And also his firm has been involved in representing a number of detainees there at Guantanamo. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Have there been difficulties for someone like you or for the other attorneys who are trying to represent people there? Have there been continued to be difficulties with either having access to the client or being able to have access to the kind of information that you would need to make your case because the government says, well, that's secret, that's national security, we really can't tell you things like that.
That is an ongoing. That has been an issue. Just you know, literally getting down to Guantanamo to talk to the clients, being able to write down what you are told. Everything has to be cleared by security officers. There are very tight security restrictions, and certainly the government claims that information is classified. So there have been fights about that. There have been ongoing fights about it. It's you know, difficult under the circumstances with the detainees at Guantanamo and with all the restrictions to do what lawyers ordinarily do in representing the clients.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit more about maybe what's likely to happen, and I guess nobody really knows, but again, what I read says that there may be some more people that the U.S. government will decide to release, or at least they will release them into the hands of the governments of the country that they came from, that there might be some that they think they actually can try by military commission. And the first one of those is set to happen, as I understand, later this month. That's the man you talked about who was Mr. Bin Laden's driver.
Mr. Hamdan.
Mr. Hamdan. And so there may be some other people like that. That apparently leaves, though, a number of people, maybe something more than 100, that the administration thinks are dangerous, but that they really don't have enough evidence to try them. And there's some talk about the president would really like to close Guantanamo because it's not very good public relations for the administration. And maybe they might take those people and then transfer them to military prisons stateside. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder how you think all of this might be likely to play out.
It's difficult to predict how it's all going to play out. Obviously, this is all against the backdrop of a presidential campaign that's ongoing now. And, you know, the habeas issue has been an issue in the presidential campaign. Senator Obama issued a statement following the Supreme Court's decision, essentially praising the Supreme Court's decision. Senator McCain denounced the Supreme Court's decision as one of the worst decisions in the nation's history. And so it's difficult to see how this will all play out, given the politics. I suspect that detainees will not be brought to the United States en masse, before the presidential election. But it's hard to predict. You know, in terms of the detainees that the administration says that are so dangerous that they don't have evidence to support it. I think my view is that if based on past history, it's difficult to credit much of what the Bush administration says about these detainees. We have had examples like Mr. Hamdi, who have been called the worst of the worst, and in fact, all of the detainees that the Bush administration has called the worst of the worst and hardened terrorists, and Bush and Rumsfeld have repeatedly said that, and that's made it more difficult actually to repatriate some people. But it has turned out really that there's often no there there. There was actually a case that was decided after the Supreme Court's decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., a case called Parhat, P-A-R-H-A-T, that was the name of one of the detainees. He had actually, his lawyers had brought a case under the statute that was passed, the Detainee Treatment Act, in the Court of Appeals, and a panel of three judges on the Court of Appeals, two of whom, one of whom was actually an appointee of the current President Bush, and one of them who's an appointee of Ronald Reagan. They looked at the government's assertions, the evidence, and they basically said there is no basis in what the government puts forth for holding this person as an enemy combatant. It's just vague assertions with no sources or any other no basis really for us to conclude as a court that this person is an enemy combatant. So if there are people that are at Guantanamo who have committed crimes have engaged in combat against the U.S., the U.S. should come up with evidence and the courts will do their job. I mean, part of what the whole habeas cases have been about is, all we're asking for is a day in court. If there's evidence against people, if they've committed crimes or if they've engaged in combat against the U.S., then the courts will hold that they can be detained. But if there's no evidence, then it's contrary to our system of government to say that we tell you they're really dangerous. Believe us, they're really dangerous, but we don't have any evidence to back it up.
We have a caller here, someone in Gibson City, not that far away from us. Line number one.
Yes, hello. First, yes. I want to say thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
And my second item is I guess that I feel that we as a country and as a people need to rise up and go against these barbaric laws. We're, I mean, other countries look at us and we're not, we don't act very civilized. That's what I want to say with this the government we have now. And we need to be, you know, I guess that how can we as a group of citizens, do you have any ideas? Because I think that's where it lies. Is we got to get up and protest. And I guess I want to say, living in this area, and anybody that living that is can hear this, that has a Muslim community, that we have a wonderful Muslim community in the Champaign-Urbana area. And I've got to know some of these people, and I think that's where it lies, is getting to know each other. And I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say. And again, I can't thank you enough for what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, one thing that that's important for people to speak out in their own communities and say that we are against holding people indefinitely without any court process. We are against our government torturing prisoners, which is the Bush administration has been doing, and speaking out and making it clear that the Bush administration does not speak for us and does not act on our behalf when it does this. As I said, these issues are have come up in the presidential campaign, and they will come up in other local campaigns. Senator Obama has spoken out forcefully in favor of habeas corpus and giving the courts a chance to do their job. He's also spoken out forcefully about ending torture by the United States and restoring our place in the world community and removing this stain that really Guantanamo has become on our reputation. Senator McCain, as I said, has denounced the Supreme Court's decision and seems desirous of more or less continuing what the Bush administration's policies have been.
And I'm sure that there are people who who share your concerns, who might also say, well, there might indeed be people who are terrorists who are held at Guantanamo. We just don't know. I guess I am thinking about, and I posed the same question to the last hour guest who's been involved in doing some of the same kind of work that you have been involved in, asking him about his reaction to some of the comments made by the dissenters in Boumediene, particularly Justice Scalia, and I guess Senator McCain has, in a sense, echoed some of those same comments, saying that as far as they're concerned, as a result of the decision, that terrorists are going to be let go and that Americans are going to die as a result. They have been very, very dramatic and very strong in what they have said about this decision. Do you have any sort of a sympathy or any sort of concern that, in fact, somebody who is genuinely guilty of terrorism and might well commit terrorist acts again is going to end up being released as a result of this?
Look, I mean, I don't want people to be released to kill anybody. There has been, I think, I've seen a couple of commentators note the irony between Justice Scalia's statement in his dissent in Boumediene that as a result of the court's decision, more Americans will be killed, and his statement in the D.C. gun ban case, in which that did not seem to faze him at all in laying out what the Second Amendment required, but. But obviously, we're not in favor of releasing people so they could kill Americans or anybody else. All we are saying is that the system or the lack of system that the Bush administration has adopted is bankrupt. And every individual at Guantanamo, anyone who's taken into custody by the United States, is entitled to some process to determine whether there's a basis for imprisoning them, whether they have done anything wrong. That's our system. And, you know, I have confidence that the courts can do their job. You know, that's what courts do. And so all we're talking about is, you know, giving each person a day in court. And I think that's to suggest that it's too dangerous to give people a day in court. Frankly, I think that's a dangerous view. And it's contrary to our core values as a country and what we've always stood for as a country. And it's contrary to the whole notion of separation of powers, which is, you know, which, as I said, was affirmed by the Supreme Court decision and the majority opinion. So I think, you know, that that's my reaction, I guess, to Justice Scalia's comment.
We have a caller here we'll get to in just a moment. Let me introduce once again the guest, Gary Isaac. He is an attorney. He's practiced law at the firm of Meyer Brown LLP in Chicago since 1986 and also since 2003 has been involved in litigation on behalf of detainees at Guantanamo, was involved in filing friend of the court briefs in all of these major cases that we have talked about that deal with Guantanamo and the people detained there, Rasul, Hamdi, and Hamdan, and also along with other lawyers has been involved in representing detainees at Guantanamo in their request for petitions for habeas corpus. Questions are welcome, 333-WYLL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You hit it on the head with that last comment. There's one thing I called in about is the idea is to give them a trial. And but Scalia and even Bush, I think, have their priorities wrong. They believe that the first obligation of government is to preserve the life, spare the life of people, or protect the lives of people. When that's not what our founding fathers had in mind. All you have to do is look at the motto of the state of Vermont: "Live free or die." Patrick Henry: "Give me liberty or give me death." And my personal favorite was Benjamin Franklin, and this gets to the heart of the matter, and that is those who would sacrifice liberty for personal safety deserve neither. And that's what the country was founded on, the preservation of liberty. And I'll take my answer off here.
I believe it's, and I agree with you, and we've quoted Ben Franklin's comments in our brief in the Supreme Court. It's always been an important quote to me. I think it is possible to balance liberty and security, obviously, but I don't believe that the Bush administration's policies they have run roughshod over our freedoms and threatened our basic principles like separation of powers and checks and balances, as the president has attempted to grab all of this power. But I also don't think it's made us safer. There has not been a single alleged terrorist convicted in the military commissions that the Bush administration has created. All that they have done by creating Guantanamo and ruining our reputation around the world is help our enemies recruit people against us because of all the hostility and anger that Guantanamo has engendered against the United States around the world. So I don't think their policies that Guantanamo has made us safer. I think it's made us less safe, and they do a lot of posturing, as Justice Scalia did in his dissent. But in fact, their system has not separated the effectively those who should be held, who there's a basis for holding, from those who haven't really done anything and there's no basis for holding. And I don't think, and they haven't even convicted a single alleged terrorist in their military commissions. All they've done is bring disrepute to the United States by attempting to create criminal procedures that are seen widely as being kangaroo procedures.
Just, we've been talking here, and we talked in the first hour, we have used this term habeas corpus a lot. And I don't know if we're taking for granted that people know exactly and understand what that means. I mean, not literally what it means, but what it means. And so maybe I should just give you the chance to talk a little bit about what exactly that is. I mean, what is it that we're talking about here?
Sure. Habeas corpus is an age-old procedure, ancient procedure. It dates back to Magna Carta in England, and so it dates back about 800 years. And the principle is very simple. The king, or in our case the president, cannot lock up any individual on his own say-so without having an independent review by an independent court to determine whether there is a basis for the imprisonment. That's what habeas corpus means. It used to literally mean, in the Latin phrase, produce the body, where the jailer would have to appear in court before the judge and bring the prisoner so that the judge could exercise jurisdiction. And if the government failed to demonstrate a basis for the imprisonment, order the release. And so that's where it comes from. But it's a Latin phrase It was considered tremendously important by the founders. In fact, it was enshrined in the Constitution in a provision that, not in the Bill of Rights, in the original Constitution that is the provision that the Supreme Court relied on in holding the Military Commissions Act provision unconstitutional a couple weeks ago. Basically, that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus may not be suspended unless in times of rebellion or invasion when the public safety requires it. Mm. And so, as our last caller rightly pointed out, the principle of preserving individual freedom preserving separation of powers and checks and balances was very much on the minds of the founders, and that's why they enshrined habeas corpus in the Constitution itself.
So is the question, the ultimate question here, whether or not the government has adequate evidence to charge a person or to try to argue their guilt, or does it actually takes a step back from that and says it challenges the right of the government to hold that person, in a sense, regardless of the quality of the evidence that they might have?
In most instances, there are different challenges that are being made by different detainees, but in large part, it's factual challenges. You got the wrong guy. You know, you were looking for someone with a similar name to my name, but I'm not that person. You know, or I mean, one of the cases that came up was a good example. Maybe we talked about it the last time I was here, David, but that came up in the oral argument in the Supreme Court in this Boumediene case that was just decided, was the case of someone who is a legal resident in Germany, and he was. I forget how he came into U.S. custody, but basically the accusation against him and the reason he was being held at Guantanamo was that a friend of his had been a suicide bomber. His name was the detainee was named Kurnaz, K-U-R-N-A-Z, and when he had a proceeding in front of the military and they told him that his friend had been a suicide bomber, he was shocked and but had no basis for objecting, and so they found him based on his being a friend or associate of someone who was a suicide bomber, that Mr. Kurnaz himself was an enemy combatant. And putting aside whether or not it's proper to hold anyone in prison because of people they know and whether it's consistent with our notions of freedom of association, but putting that aside, it turns out, and Mr. Kurnaz's lawyers were able to find out and present the evidence, that the friend who allegedly was a suicide bomber was not a suicide bomber, was in fact alive and well and living, not under any suspicion in Germany. So the whole premise of the government's case was just factually false. And so habeas corpus and these hearings are important just to give the detainees a chance to go to court represented by counsel and say, you got the wrong person, or the factual premise of you're holding me is totally wrong. I can prove it's wrong. I wasn't where you say I was. I was, you know, working somewhere else. I can prove it. You know, so really that's the essence of many or most of the challenges here. It's not to the legal authority, it's to the facts. And actually in the Boumediene case, the Supreme Court said that, you know, that's fundamentally what the detainees had been denied, and what habeas corpus really guarantees them is the ability to come to court and through their lawyers and present evidence that shows that there's not a basis for holding them. Facts.
We have a couple of other callers here, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk next with someone on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
This past year, I had a chance to work with a student from Lakeland who was from Azerbaijan, and isn't there a problem of Americans not understanding the cultural differences of these people from that part of the world? I mean, he doesn't think we have any business being over in that part of the world in the first place. But he took me to mosque in Effingham and I got to attend services there. And wouldn't it be better if we expanded our Peace Corps and had a little better understanding of the cultural differences and expanded our geography programs in our schools? I mean, after junior high, our kids are never exposed. They can't even identify where Azerbaijan is in the world. Isn't this part of the problem, is Americans don't understand the cultural differences?
Well, I think, you know, that it certainly, I would agree that there are many other things that we could be doing in other parts of the world that would be effective. You know, there was actually a story in the New York Times, I think on Sunday, about a man who took it upon himself. He's gone to Afghanistan and he's raised money privately to actually build schools because he believes that one of the best ways to combat Islamic extremism is to actually build schools and provide education to kids. And his work has encountered tremendous sympathy, and people have been incredibly enthusiastic in Afghanistan and helped him. He goes to local villages and he builds schools. And it quoted someone from the military in Afghanistan who says this is a tremendously effective thing to be doing, and we ought to be doing more of it. So I think there's certainly more that we could be doing. And really the point that I was trying to make before, which is that creating Guantanamo, holding prisoners without any kind of process, engaging in torture, that has demeaned us, that has engendered hostility towards us around the world. It's made it much more difficult to form the kinds of coalitions that we need and should be working as part of to make all of us safer.
I appreciate your comments because, you know, I listen to WLO. I don't think I've heard Azerbaijan ever mentioned on that station.
Mm-hmm.
I always say do a program on some of the countries like Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan to educate the people about these countries and about the Peace Corps. They don't even do any PSAs on the Peace Corps on WILO. Okay, thank you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Champaign and on line two. Hello.
Yes, if I'm not mistaken, this is another one of those 5-4 decisions.
It was, yes.
I have trouble pronouncing it, but I enjoy hearing you pronounce it.
I'll do it again. Boumediene.
Boumediene. Let me say, now let me put this in political terms. There are, of course, four hardcore conservatives who were in the dissent here. Kennedy seems to be the man in the middle, the swing man, and you got your four liberals. If by chance, and I hope this doesn't happen, if McCain, and it surprises me he's been so adamant in expanding presidential powers in the Guantanamo cases. If he's elected president and assumes office on January 20, 2009, and, of course, we have a couple of liberals, Ginsburg and Stevens, who are getting up in age and have ill health, at least Ginsburg does, is it conceivable that McCain could appoint judges of the ilk of Roberts and Scalia, whom he's promised to appoint, and this case could come back, or a similar case, rather, and this decision could be overruled?
Well, technically, the Supreme Court, it is not supposed to just ignore cases recently decided. But yes, that there is certainly a risk if the composition of the court changes, if Senator McCain is elected and one or more of the justices that were in the majority in the Boumediene case is replaced by justices like Alito and Roberts, which is what McCain said he would do. There's certainly a risk that another court in another case could reach a different result.
So in essence, elections for president matter in terms of things like Supreme Court nominations, right?
Oh, very, 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 very much.
I don't think people are told that these days, or maybe it just falls low in their priorities. Another quick question, and I don't understand what this means, but in this meaningless press conference that Bush puts on, and I don't know why WILO, and this is a swipe at David and WIL, why they even waste our time listening to that propaganda and those evasive answers. But Bush keeps drawing a dichotomy between, and of course, criticizing the Democrats and, I guess, Senator Obama. He's saying this is a war, not a law enforcement matter, this war on terror. Mm. Is there some significance in terms of the positions they've held in all the Gitmo cases about a war and not a law enforcement and how they've tried to proceed?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is it's a political device designed to scare people and intimidate people into not opposing their position. If you cast everything in terms of a war, if you oppose their position, then you're against the U.S. in the war. And, in fact, there were some suggestions a year ago by a since-resigned deputy Secretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs, a fellow named Cully Simpson, who suggested the lawyers representing the detainees were, acting unpatriotically and should suffer consequences in their careers because they were doing this work and their clients should fire them. And he was forced to resign. I think, to some extent, and also, but invoking the war paradigm as opposed to the criminal law is also just an effort to justify more greater executive, you know, presidential power and less judicial oversight because, again, of the exigency that's presented in a war situation. But the mere fact that we are at war, as the Supreme Court has said, doesn't mean the president gets a blank check on the Constitution, and our system of government still prevails in separation of powers and the role of the courts, even in time of war. The courts may give the president a bit more deference in times of war when there are exigencies, but one of the issues here is that these detainees at Guantanamo have been held for 6 years.
Right.
And, you know, and even the, you know, most studies have shown there was a, you know, it's come out in different reports that, you know, CIA analysts thought that only a small fraction of the detainees were actually threats to us or had engaged in any hostilities against the U.S. I've seen a number of one study that showed that only 8% might have had anything to do with Al-Qaeda, that, you know, only a small fraction even engaged in hostilities. But the Bush administration, whenever they've been presented with that kind of information, has basically said, the president has decided they are all enemy combatants. We are not going to revisit that.
So, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left, actually, maybe more like about, well, I'll say 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Gary Isaac. He is an attorney with the firm of Meyer Brown LLP in Chicago, has practiced law there since 1986, and for a number of years has been an attorney involved in litigation on behalf of detainees at Guantanamo. As I mentioned, that he was involved in filing a friend of the court briefs in all of the major decisions, these three major decisions that the Supreme Court has handed down since 2004, Rasul, Hamdi, and Hamdan, and also continues to be involved in a group of attorneys that have brought habeas actions on behalf of the detainees, asserting their right to challenge their detention in court. That was really what these decisions, and also the Boumediene decision, the most recent one, have really been all about. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Somebody in Coles County is next. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
With the 8th Infantry Division in World War II, and on a semi-routine day, we took out a German gun emplacement, machine gun emplacement, killed 4 and captured 2. Now, if these guys end up in a POW camp and submit a writ of habeas corpus, how are we going to round up members of the squad to identify these people as having been there shooting at us, that one was in a Wehrmacht uniform and the other in a Waffen SS?
Well, if someone were captured in a uniform of someone we're fighting against, if a habeas corpus petition were to be filed on their behalf, it would not result in very much procedure, because I think the court would quickly conclude that if someone is wearing the uniform of the enemy and firing arms against us, they can be detained as an enemy combatant or a POW, as the Supreme Court
has said.
What
if they denied that?
What's that?
What if they denied that they were in uniform?
Well,
how are we going to get testimony that they were? And after all the rest we went through, we certainly aren't going to be able to identify them by their face or anything.
That's never been an issue in past wars. The problem here is that many of the detainees, or most of them, have not been captured anywhere near any battlefield. They were not. They're not all even alleged to have been on battlefields, and some of them were captured not even anywhere near Afghanistan or Pakistan.
Well, there's battlefields in the current war on terror is not any nicely defined places in most instances, so that doesn't strike me as really being relevant in this particular case.
Well, it's relevant in that it is the circumstances under which someone can be swept up and as a putative enemy combatant, as demonstrated by what's actually happened with the detainees at Guantanamo, is people do get swept up. People like Mr. Kurnaz, who are being held because their friend supposedly was a suicide bomber, and it's just not true. And so we have to give people some process in order to demonstrate that there's no basis for imprisoning them. Otherwise, you'd be suggesting, maybe you are, and you're entitled to that view. I would strongly disagree with it, that simply because there are people who might want to attack us, that we should be able to round up anyone we think, the president ought to be able to round up anyone he thinks might be dangerous or might know someone who's dangerous and just hold them forever.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because we're tight on time, and I've got some other people I want to get in. But just to reinforce that question, does this, let's say we are talking about a battlefield situation, and we're talking about American soldiers who are taking prisoners, people who clearly were shooting at them, and maybe we'll complicate it by, we'll say, well, they're not wearing a recognized military uniform, but clearly they were shooting at them. Does this make it things any more difficult for American soldiers who are in that position of taking enemy, taking prisoners, people who clearly are hostile?
Well, there actually are. The military has its own procedures for separating actual combatants from innocent civilians, and this is in the Geneva Conventions, but it's also in Military Regulation 190-8. And basically, they're supposed to have proceedings in the field, panels of military officers to anyone is taken into custody and denies that they were combatants. They're supposed to have proceedings in the field to determine whether they actually were combatants or not. And we actually had these proceedings in the field during the first Gulf War, and I think two-thirds of the people who had these proceedings were actually found not to be enemy combatants and innocent civilians. And again, this is part of the Geneva Conventions as well. And in this case, the military wanted to have these kinds of hearings in the field in Afghanistan, and the Bush administration overruled them and declined to have these kind of hearings. So part of the problem is the military has procedures, you know, at or near the time of capture to make some initial determinations of whether there's a basis for holding someone as an enemy combatant or whether they're an innocent civilian. But the Bush administration declined to have those kinds of proceedings. So this is not it's not totally out of left field, the notion that we should not just be able to sweep up someone as an enemy and hold them even if they are denying that they that they've engaged in any hostilities. The own military procedures acknowledge that there should be some kind of proceeding in the field.
All right, let's go next to someone in Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hi. Two things came to my mind. There's an ungodly amount of treasure of PhDs coming out of this Bush group, I'm sure, and the historians. And I wondered from the perspective of the law, are there a lot of things that Bush and his boys have done that's going to be brought up, you know, like 5-10 years from now? This is not the way we do law, kids. This is the way we go. We really do believe in habeas corpus. I was wondering if that would be an issue when it gets into the law schools, how those teachers fall on one side of the fence and the other, especially guys like Scalia. Thanks.
Well, you know, it's not... Obviously, there is some debate within the legal community, although, you know, there have been, when we have been lobbying against against congressional efforts to take the jurisdiction of the courts away, you know, we've had the support of law professors and law deans and retired judges. And frankly, you know, I've seen no similar letters coming from the other side. And in fact, you know, many of the people who have opposed the congressional efforts to take away the court's jurisdiction are people who are notable conservatives. David Keene, the president of the American Conservative Union, the conservative legal scholar Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago. I think, frankly, it's a fundamentally conservative notion, or it ought to be, that the president should not have the authority to lock anyone up on his own say-so without an independent review by the courts. You know, when I was growing up, in the 60s, it was the notion of, as a conservative, that you were wary of government power and wary of governmental authority. And I think, you know, actually, it's this administration has taken the radical approach of trying to grab all the power and undermine all the other checks and balances on the president.
One more caller here, Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have 2 points. One, I thank you for being on, and I hope you appreciate the educating that you're doing, and I hope you do these kinds of things and presentations as often as you possibly can. Number two, I want to ask a little something about our Constitution. Looking back, whether it's to Roosevelt or many other times, when we have strayed from our Constitution, we've not had a good result. And it seems to me we ignore our Constitution at our peril. One thing that I think other people from abroad might wonder, we talk a lot about our Constitution and how much we love it and how wonderful it is. But sometimes we're willing to take a shortcut if it seems, and I'm talking about Guantanamo, And I wonder if other people don't say, well, you know, they give a lot of lip service to that Constitution, but when the going gets tough, maybe they don't think it's so great after all. And I would just like to hear a few comments from you on whether or not you think we should really pay attention to what our Constitution says and stay true to it, because we wouldn't have this Guantanamo mess if we had done that, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I can give you, Mr. Isaac, about a minute.
Well, that's a great question. I obviously do believe strongly in our Constitution. It's a wonderful document, and it has served us well since it was adopted. I think we should continue to look to it. And the great thing about our country is the freedoms that we have is that we do live in a free society. We have three branches of government. I think the founders were very wise to create the system of checks and balances. And we may agree or disagree with particular branches, but having the three branches of government, I think, is a real bulwark to preserve our freedom. And we ignore or undercut the Constitution at our peril. We should honor and cherish it, and we should follow it.
Just real quick, does the recent decision, that the Boumediene decision, does that do anything to the plan now later this month to try Mr. Hamdan in a military commission trial, or do you think that's going to go ahead?
I think that's an issue that's unresolved. The government says it should have no effect on the trial, and Mr. Hamdan's lawyers say it should put a stop to the trial while he pursues a habeas corpus case. So I think that issue is something that we'll be seeing more of.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, with our thanks to our guest for this morning, Gary Isaac. He is an attorney with the firm of Meyer Brown LLP in Chicago, has been practicing law there since 1986, and since 2004 has been involved in the litigation on behalf of the detainees at Guantanamo. Mr. Isaac, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about these important issues.